Hey everybody, this week we bring you another Jug Life Classic episode. This time we throw it back to episode number 51, Strength in Academia, featuring Dr. Mike Isratel and Jared Feather, both of Renaissance Periodization. Jared was a master's student under Dr. Mike, so we talked to these guys about the process of educating yourself in the fields of strength, conditioning, nutrition, and how to best utilize that process to eventually find a successful career in the field. Give it a listen, enjoy, make sure to subscribe to the podcast, share it with a friend.
Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here. This is another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I am joined today by a wonderful panel of guests. My co-host, as always, Marvelous Max Montana.
Hey guys.
And we have RP co-founder, is that the proper term for you?
I believe so. That's what the lawyers say I can say.
Head science consultant, Dr. Mike Isratel.
Howdy.
As well as ICP pro bodybuilder.
Insane clown posse.
It is the juggler.
They're giving out like pro cards now.
IPE, natural pro bodybuilder, RP coach, juggernaut lackey, Jared Feather.
Mm-hmm. AKA Mankini.
Mankini. It is. And so we got great stuff we're going to talk about today about strength in academia. Mike has spent the last, how many years in the?
Five.
As a professor at both the University of Central Missouri and at Temple. And Jared is finishing up his master's in exercise physiology.
Yeah, exercise science. Same thing.
At UCM. Was a pupil, the star pupil, I guess.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of extracurricular
work. A lot of cheating. He cheated every opportunity.
See me after class, a lot of that.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
Dr. Mike, today's episode is brought to you by Speedos and Speed Squats. It's a lifestyle.
I love that company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's. Imagine doing Speed Squats while wearing a Speedo. You probably do that.
Well, it's a lifestyle.
Do you mean remember?
How many Instagram likes do you think you can get from that right camera angle?
Whoa. The world may never know.
It's all about the knees out.
Yeah.
Spread the floor.
If the cues are good, if I have one bit of, what is that called?
Anterior pelvic tilt.
Butt wink, then it's lights out.
So Mike has been a professor now for 5 years after earning his PhD from ETSU in sport physiology. And you know, I get questions all the time about what degree should I get, you know, if I want to be a coach, if I want to open a gym, if I want to do the stuff that we do. And I really have no idea because my degree is in history, the regular kind of history, not the sport history.
Mm.
And so I can't give them a good answer. So I'm very excited to have these two guys here to give insight into the way that training and nutrition and all this stuff is treated in the university setting.
It was a very common question we get all the time, too.
So, Mike, what would you say, as you look back at your last 5 years, the thing that UCM, Temple, the greater university setting does really well in regards to teaching about training?
I'll tell you what it does super, super well in most exercise science departments for undergraduates and even for master's students is it gives you a really good basic physiological understanding, a good underpinning of basic physiology, motor control, biomechanics, the very foundational concepts from which we eventually, after a lot of practical insights which are not taught at that level, from which we derive training recommendations, coaching cues, etc. One thing that can do for you super well is if you eventually want to be the best coach you can be, it's really hard to get away from just buying into tradition and how things people have done before because you lack the critical understanding of, well, does this actually make sense with regard to biology? Because if you don't know the biology, it's tough. And you can't really learn biology just Googling articles, even if they're PubMed articles, because they're really super specific all the time. And a lot of things that people say online, not all of them, of course, just nonsense as far as physiology is concerned. So how do you parse that out? If you have a good physiological understanding, you're well on your way. The big limitation to that is if you just have a physiological understanding, you need to learn so much more about how to apply that if you just start applying it, you're going to make all kinds of crazy, crazy mistakes. So school by itself, in most programs, you're woefully, woefully ill-prepared to coach. But if you want to go about and through other means, maybe an internship or just an involvement in strength training yourself and in coaching and reading more practical, more applied literature and talking to coaches, going to seminars like the Juggernaut ones you guys put on, if you stack that on top of a basic physiological understanding, you're going to go way further in your creativity, your originality, your skepticism, and your ability to design programs than you would if you simply got the practical side and never learned the biological side to it, especially as far as bullshit detection is concerned. A lot of stuff people fall for, like, hey, what do you think about this training program? Like, that doesn't make any damn sense as far as tissue construction is concerned. And they're like, well, what do you mean by that? And I'm like, when have you taken exercise phys, basic muscle phys? And I'm like, why? I've never taken that. And you're like, well, here's this chapter out of this book. It's an uphill battle for sure. Mm-hmm. And you can get that knowledge yourself, but the academy does a really good job of giving you that basic foundational knowledge. If you're going in there to try to learn how to do snatches and clean and jerks, how to program, oh my God. Most of your professors don't even lift weights. Their understanding of muscle and strength ends with a muscle contracts due to the following parameters in a laboratory. But if you want to know really, really, really deep stuff, knowing that laboratory stuff is a good idea.
Doesn't the CrossFit Level 1 just cover most of that?
CrossFit Level 1 covers more than that. It's usually more than a PhD. I would say it's about 10 years of professorship after a PhD.
You're tenured after CrossFit Level 2,
you basically
2,
right? See things by molecule.
Okay.
Like, it's pretty serious.
So, I mean, you already started talking about it, obviously, that the biggest downfall is going to be failure to equip people with the practical knowledge, that the ability to apply things.
I don't know if all programs offer this, but for sure mine did, and we do in the master's program as well, but we have actual training courses where they set us up with a specific client, and we had to do one for, like, adapted physical education. We had to do one for just basic personal training. And now in my master's course, we have one where I think it's kind of setting up programs for teams, strength and conditioning, actually. So my program was really good about practical application as well, rather than just the biology side of things.
Very much in the minority as far as programs.
Oh, for sure. But I mean, if you find the right program, you can always see the curriculum and what you're going to go through in the classes and stuff.
Yeah.
I'd imagine UCM is probably in the minority that you had three RP coaches as professors at some point.
Yeah.
Left so a that bit was of a mark. Yeah. Yep. We had Dr. Goddard, Dr. Jen Case, and myself teaching at the same time, and that brought quite a bit of sports science interest. I would say that, so what I said generally applies to academia. There are some master's programs especially, and one PhD program for sure, the one at East Tennessee State, in which the whole purpose of the education is sport coaching. So take my PhD program, for example. They have a couple of these around the world, but they're very rare in the United States. And there might be one or two programs in the U.S., other than the one at East Tennessee, that focus so much on sport. But when I got there for my interview, Dr. Stone, who runs the program, basically said, like if you're interested, and they also said this at the orientation on the first day, which is hilarious, because if you sign up for the program on the first day, in the orientation talk, he tells you you're here for the wrong reason. You're like, ugh. I thought this was going to be about cardiac rehab. But he basically said, he's like, if you're interested in rehabilitating people who are injured, that is all well and good. That is not what we learn here. If you're interested in general health, we don't learn that here. If you're interested in adult fitness, we don't learn that here. We're exclusively concerned with the scientific approach to taking good athletes and making them as good as they can be. And I, of course, was like, oh my God, am I in the right place? But it's a very, very rare place. So individuals that come out of East Tennessee State are remarkably adept at coaching, but because that's all we learn about. It's a sport physiology, so it's taking that physiology and translating into how does this apply to coaching. So a bunch of our classes, it's like, what would you do with this athlete? You're like, that. He's like, wrong, and here's why. And you're like, okay. So, but that's really super rare.
For the uninitiated, can you make a quick elaborate a little bit on the difference between exercise physiology, a much more common program, and sport physiology?
Yeah, so exercise physiology is basically most of the time or exercise science uses exercise as a way to try to understand physiology. So they'll, for example, try to understand how liver enzymes change, and they'll use exercise to change them, and the control group won't exercise, and they'll see, okay, this gives us more insight into liver enzymes and how they work. And a lot of times, some of the applications from that, the most common ones, are for health. Okay, if we know how to alter liver enzymes and exercise does it in the following ways, we have ideas about drug therapy that we can use. Like, if exercise does this, can a drug do this as well, like some kind of liver drug? Or how to use exercise as therapy, or we can use it to try to find out about injury risks and healing and stuff like that. That's mostly exercise science. Sports science takes the insights of exercise science and tries to apply them to making athletes better. So sports science doesn't study physiology for its own sake. It studies physiology and how the body works with the end goal always, okay, how does this make me better at sport? And that is a really awesome thing about sports science. Not that exercise science isn't amazing, I mean, that basis is critical, but sports science is really, you can answer every question in sports. You always have a direction in sports. Whenever you walk into a sports science classroom, the end goal of every talk, of every lecture, of every semester, of every test is, and how does this make us better at sport? Period. Because if it doesn't answer that question, you just don't learn about it. So a lot of times people message me and be like, hey, so they'll ask me about health. And luckily I'm educated in health as well through other means. I sure as heck didn't learn that in sport physiology PhD. I'll say, well, you know, that's not really my area of expertise. A lot of times it's questions for medical doctors. And yeah, I know physiology, but I don't know it to the extent that I can help someone medically in a serious way. My question is, okay, if you're healthy and relatively well, what do we do with your physiology to make you as good as possible? And it's a really rare. There are not that many sports science programs around. However, I've noticed from writing a lot of recommendation letters and stuff like that for students, they're growing in number. So there's a lot of master's programs now which have maybe not a whole sports science curriculum, but they have a couple of classes that are like athletic performance, sport performance enhancement, periodization, stuff like that. It used to be 10 years ago, it was all physiology and all clinical stuff, like how do you get diabetics to be less diabetic by giving them drugs and training them. And by training, we mean like treadmill walks at 5 miles an hour or something like that.
And maybe it's just because of the, you know, area, my area of interest and the people I'm surrounded by. But it seems to me that most 18, 20-year-old kids, when they're going into this, into these majors, are wanting the sports science side of things. That's their real passion. That's what they're really interested in, but they're not getting that.
I'll tell you, man, one of the biggest mistakes I see students make chronically is they want to be pedigreed, like they want to have a degree, and they know that they can learn a lot of practical stuff from non-academic sources, so that's covered. And so they'll go what is like a geographically or financially convenient program. Oops. So they'll go to a geographically or financially convenient program, something that's close to them. And what that ends up doing is they're like, well, I know it's an exercise science, but I've literally had this conversation with multiple people. I know it's exercise science, but it's close to home. It's not super expensive. And I don't learn anything about sports, but I'm going to get this degree, and then I'm going to coach people. And it's like, you really want to learn stuff to apply to your coaching job. If you want to be a coach, you got to go out to places to find the programs where they are. When I was graduating undergrad in the University of Michigan, we had a master's program. But it, for example, one of the biggest lines of research there was studying movement in babies with Down syndrome and trying to get them to, because they have a motor delay, right? They don't do stuff babies usually do at certain time frames. So the idea was to try to figure out how to make them more independent faster. And it's a phenomenal line of research, incredibly awesome. But just like, how are you going to be a better coach learning that stuff? You're not. Right. It has nothing to do with it. So I could have stayed at the University of Michigan and pursued that. Where did I go? I went to Appalachian State University. And people were asking me, like, why? I'm like, because Dr. Jeff McBride and Dr. Travis Triplett are there, and they know strength training.
I thought it was because App State beat Michigan that year.
The year I got there, literally 3 days later, App State beat Michigan in football. Mm-hmm. I take, I mean, charitable, 95% of the credit. I ran most of the plays myself.
They won it for you. They're like, we have to show Mike how appreciated
we want Dr. Mike Isertel of Facebook to stay.
Of Facebook.
And, and then, you know, it's funny, as Nick Shaw and I, actually a co-founder of RP, we worked together in New York City at a personal training studio. And when I put in my papers to leave because, you know, 2 week notice or whatever, people start asking me, you know, my clients are like, where are you going? And I was like, well, PhD program. And they're like, oh, cool. Where? And I'm like, East Tennessee. And they're like, you know, these are New Yorkers, businessmen. Right, they're like, well, how are you going to East Tennessee? Like, isn't there anything like that here in New York? And I'm like, no, there's actually just not. So you got to go out. And if you want to be a sport coach, you're going to be in a weird town, and maybe not weird, but like out of the way place.
Quite. I've spent a bit of time in Johnson City.
How? What percent of that time were you sober? You threw sober, I assume.
Yeah.
Mostly
yeah.
Sober. Anyway.
50-50.
Cool. So,
$2 you call it at Poor Richard's.
The drinking, if you want to get your drinking on, I mean, it's pretty impressive.
50-50, does that include sleeping time? Because that would be most sleeping time.
It's hard to. We'll say that both times we had our indoor national championships for the NAI at ETSU, and what do they call it? The Thunderdome or something? I'm going to call it the Thunderdome.
That's fine.
Yeah, Thunderdome.
Mini dome.
We may have been there at the same time. We may have even crossed paths.
Ooh, I don't know about that. I'd feel your power level.
2009?
Nope, I got there the next year. I was in New York.
The dome wouldn't have been able to handle it.
For sure.
Chad paved the way for you.
More or less. Chad, like, he told Dr. Stone, he's like, Mike's coming.
Yeah, we would compete and then, you know, finish the meet on Sunday or whatever. And we'd always have like a 6:30 a.m. flight out of Knoxville. Mm. So you just go right through.
Yeah.
There's no need for sleeping there.
God. Terrible.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah,
it always
for sure.
Sounds like a good idea.
Oh, yeah, it'll be fun.
4 a.m. flight. I'll just stay up all night.
Well, when you're young.
Yeah.
I was young.
And then you're like waiting at the gate, and the seconds are going by like.
Yeah.
I did at the. Now looking back, I know that I had an interaction for sure with Dr. Stone. I remember going in that weight room inside the mini Thunderdome because I wanted to get a little train session the day before the meet.
Uh-huh.
And we had a bit of interaction there.
Was it like a tussle?
No.
Very intense guy.
Yeah. And is Indian leg wrestling Indian leg tussling?
It depends on the emotionality behind it.
Yeah. He's like, oh, you want to lift these weights? Let's Indian leg wrestle for it. This is the entry fee. But
you have to strap up.
I don't know.
But tell us about Dr. Stone, and I mean, I know he played a pivotal role in your development into this.
Yeah. Dr. Stone is the curmudgeoniest old man of curmudgeony old men.
Mm. I feel like Max knows a lot of guys who could probably.
I do know a lot of old curmudgeony men.
Dr. Stone would probably say, nah, you'd be surprised at how curmudgeony I really am. And he means it. Dr. Stone happened to be around for every single great strength feat in the United States in person.
Mm-hmm.
He trained with Bill Kazmaier. He recounted a story to me that Bill Kazmaier could deadlift over 1,000 with straps, but the reason that he couldn't deadlift 1,000 without straps is because when he got heavy enough to deadlift 1,000, which was into the 350s, his hand would hypertrophy so much he couldn't grip the barbell. I remember hearing that and just being like waves of shock just flowing over my body, be like,
nice.
What level of jacked is that? So Doc had this incredible pedigree of coming, published over 250 peer-reviewed articles and studies on periodization and strength training.
Which is like 10 times as much as anyone else.
Right? I mean, 10 times as much as someone who publishes plenty.
Yeah.
And the topics were all like weightlifting related. Like he tested weightlifters. He was, before he got to East Tennessee State, he was the chair of sport at Edinburgh University in Scotland. A bit before that, I think he was the head sport physiologist at the U.S. Olympic Training Center. He left that position because he wanted to do more, which is kind of insane. Hmm. Like, if that's your title, I'd be like, I'm the man. I'm literally the king. Like, I go anywhere else. Like, he wanted more. He started the PhD program. He is curmudgeony and incredibly skeptical, and he knows a ton of stuff. And he won't let you get away with anything as far as, like, sloppy thinking. Well, what about – I remember the first time – one of my first interactions with him, and I was like, well, you know, and then central nervous system fatigue. He's like, man, what's that? And I was like, well, you know, CNS fatigue. And he's like, you mean fatigue? And I was like, do I? He's like, yeah, you do. And I was like, okay. He's like, fatigue comes from everywhere.
I love how Mike paints himself in these stories as though he's like a cartoon character, like talking to the old neighbor. Do I?
Basically. Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing.
Dennis the Menace.
Yeah, totally.
The first time
Mr. Wilson.
I was trying to answer questions in his class, and when we were walking out of one of his classes, he's like, don't you know any sports science? And I was like, no, that's why I'm here. So he knew I knew a lot of exercise physiology, but I didn't know sport physiology at all. So all we learned about was progression models, periodization, all this kind of stuff. And if you want to go to East Tennessee State University, you want to go to a master's program in sport coaching, you want to go to the sport phys or sport coaching PhD program, you'll be incredibly well prepared. You've got to be tough because it's super hard. You have to be responsible for publishing research, probably teaching classes and coaching athletes all at the same time, which is incredibly rare. So if you're at East Tennessee State, you work with athletes. Most students in master's PhD program will never see an athlete. They'll see a laboratory. You're expected to be a sports scientist, and you're expected to learn right on the fly. So it was a phenomenal program, trial by fire for sure. But after that, you know, I got a ton of experience. I was a strength and conditioning coach for years at East Tennessee State. Got a ton of practice, learned from people that were no more knowledgeable than me, and it was an incredible experience, to say the least.
Wow.
It's really cool because the fact that you learn underneath Dr. Stone, I remember I would go to the library and I would look into journals, and that's the name I would look for. Like before you got to UCM, like my sophomore, freshman year, I was also learning from Dr. Stone, but indirectly while you were studying underneath
him. He's got a hell of a reach.
Yeah, it was insane. That's the first name I would look for is Stone.
I think that's the big distinction right there is the working with athletes versus the laboratory. Having the weight room, having the track, having the field be your laboratory is what is paramount, I think, for coaching success. So to say, neither Max or I are formally educated in training. I did that. I was purposeful in not doing that. When I went to Berkeley, they didn't have the real exercise science. So I think they didn't even have kinesiology. It would have been public health would have been the closest thing.
Jeez,
so
yeah.
I knew to steer clear of that. And then when I transferred down to Concordia, I knew that they had an exercise science program. But at that point, I had done enough reading and stuff of my own to certainly be indoctrinated with the idea that America does not do this well.
Yeah, Dr. Stone told us a lot of times. So.
Yeah, and so one of the real formative things, and I'm sure you guys have probably seen this, is a very long interview with Veroshansky on YouTube, like an hour and a half or 2 hour interview with him. And in it, he talks about the Soviet like sport coaching education system and how, you know, in America, you have to have this certification to cut hair or
a license.
Yeah. You know, all these seemingly, you know, how bad could you really fuck up a haircut?
Right.
And well, that's
intentional.
Yeah, that's as bad as it could get.
Yeah.
Where if you're fucking up people's training, you know, they're tearing ACLs, they're blowing out discs, all this stuff. So that's what made me, you know, forego the formal education part and just try and self-educate as well as possible. And I think, you know, for both Max and I, it seems to have turned out quite well. But I definitely don't have the, you know, anatomy, physiology background, and that is one thing I really wish I did have.
Well, you know, it's funny because like you and I talk quite frequently about training, and the kind of questions you'll ask me is, you know, obviously you don't ask me questions about programming. Like every now and again, you'll like send me a program look over that you're doing, or like what do you think, just to shit test it. But like you're not like, hey, you know, should I do sets of five here, or sets of three? You're like, some new kind of training claim will come up, and you'll be like, hey, Mike, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I'll be like, well, here's the physiological reason why that's wrong, and then it makes sense to you in retrospect. And that's what, like, that understanding of physiology gives me, is that ability to take a completely new claim that to you might sound like it could be correct, and to me sounds just bafflingly ignorant, right? So it's great to be able to do that, but at the same time, can you train athletes at a very high level super effectively if you have discovered the methods that work super well? Yeah, and you guys both, like, basically somehow weaved towards modern periodization. Well, you did a whole lot of squatting every day before you did that shit, but you guys are basically now, your training practices reflect kind of the cusp of what science over the years has said to do, and that's really sweet. The one thing that I would say you could reference out when you do is, like, new stuff that seems like maybe it works. And there's, like, the, you know, I'm ignorant to injury stuff, so I'll talk to Dr. Quinn. He'd be like, Quinn, what's this with this new, like, this and that, like, fascia blending, myofascial super release? And he's like, it's dumb. And I'm like, say no more.
Have you heard the new thing where you mummify yourself in voodoo floss?
Oh. That's new?
Well, you have to do a snatch while completely mummifying in voodoo floss.
It's called voodoo floss. Like, that's so cool. It just sounds so cool.
It is a cool
name. If it was just floss, it'd be like, what? I didn't do that with my teeth.
Mummified in voodoo floss, and there was, like, you know, those, like, ball pits that you'd have at McDonald's, like the play pit things
filled with lacrosse balls.
Yeah,
you jumped in.
Lacrosse balls and the supernova ones.
Supernovas. Well, for one, this ball pit would cost $18,000.
What's a supernova?
An expensive lacrosse ball.
It breaks.
It's ribbed.
It's an expensive lacrosse ball that can break. Someone managed to make a product that falls apart. Lacrosse ball out. That has an expiration date on it.
That's to roll out your stuff or whatever.
Yeah, if you submerged yourself in that, and then it would be like it you're... It would be like finishing a baptism.
I envision you would jump in and you would pop out in slow motion like in any of the numerous, like, you know, Chuck Norris action films where the seals come out of the water, like explode out of the water with like two machine guns, completely mobilized and
super
ready to snatch.
Mobile. Like you can shoot your machine guns like back from behind you.
Yeah. You'd go under mummified
and pop out. It would
you'd come out with a 220-kilo snatch.
Yeah, I kind
of
thought
you'd
like
pop out of the water with a snatch. Yeah, out of the balls.
Super advanced aliens, like somehow they like are trying to, you know, they're like around in some desert, and you happen to break your leg in front of them, and they're like compassionate. They take you to the ship, and they have like nanobots go in and just completely reconstruct your leg in front of you in 3 seconds, and they're like, "Does that feel better?" Like, "Oh my god, this is amazing." They're like, "Bet you guys don't have this on Earth." They'd be like, "Actually, like I'm probably gonna roll this out. We have that. It's called like lacrosse foam rolling and stuff." And they'd be like, "Just drop this guy."
Have you not heard of a rumble roller?
Basically, these nanobots are bullshit compared to that. They're probably expensive. This,
you know. No, it's cool. It's got bumps on the roller. The bumps do the releasing.
They're really like at the tip of the spear. You should be like a foam roller salesman. Now, I know you're looking at the bumps and they scare you, but I'm telling you, that's where the action happens.
I know they said terminal illness, but have you tried the bumpy foam roller?
You used to probably roll in with 50 bumps per roller. Our bumpy roller has 75. Now, can you imagine 25 more bumpies?
No one else has this many bumps per square inch on their foam rollers.
The government might actually regulate us out of existence. It's illegal to provide this many bumpies. Now, for a limited time of 5 easy payments of $19.99 you can have that, including voodoo floss.
Do you think there's a guy in L.A. somewhere driving around a van selling illegal foam rollers? Government didn't want to have this.
It's not street legal.
Yeah. How many bumpies you want? 75? Yeah, it's going to be $200. Quick.
It's put in your trunk.
Yeah. Cop walks by. They're like, "Oh, hello. Good day, officer." Hide the foam roller. Cop looks at the foam roller. He's like, "Okay. This doesn't look illegal. Please continue."
What were we talking about? Oh, yeah. Sports science and stuff.
Foam rolling.
Yeah. So, yeah, you got to go through kind of the bit of the best of both worlds. The deep physiology understanding paired with the coaching education side of things.
Yep.
So if Dr. Mike is the American head of sport coaching education, how's it going to look? Just lay out the curriculum day by day, preferably.
You misspoke. It would be Trump's America sport coaching education.
Are you the czar of education in Trump's America?
I just want to like fuck up and then have like to testify, and then that'd be sweet. Like, American sports czar, rumors of Russian involvement. I am Russian. They're like, "This is already bad." You know, it's an interesting question you asked me, because I'm politically libertarian and I don't think there should be an overarching government body. So the answer is dismantle it and get myself a pay cut and leave. But if I was in charge of a large sport governing body that was voluntarily associated or something like that, I would make sure that there was a standard for coach education, that if you got to work with youth, that you were exceptionally well qualified. That the upside down nature of the U.S. system, if you tell it to other people who have formal sport programs, it baffles people. To coach youth in the United States, you need to show up and maybe not always have alcohol on your breath. Even that's probably optional. If you're coaching high level people, people want you to have some qualifications. But as we all know from studying periodization, long-term athlete development, it's critical to make sure you do pretty good stuff early. Mm-hmm. So there was like kind of not a controversy, but this revelation that quite a few Olympic medalists in China and weightlifting and other sports are like jobless, or some rumors of homeless. I doubt they're homeless, but they're not working in a sports structure. When I heard that, it wasn't remotely a surprise to me. It wasn't remotely a surprise to Dr. Stone. Why? The way you coach people is you're educated to coach people. If that individual, after the conclusion of their lifting career, wanted to go back through the school system get through the coaching stuff, they don't just like – in America, you're a good athlete, you get to coach, which, as we've seen, can be incredibly awesome, because a lot of good athletes have a phenomenal understanding, case in point, of how things work. But as we all know, a lot of athletes that are good have no
fucking idea what the hell is going on. They were good to a sheer accident of genetics and hard work. And in most places that do formal sport organization, you have to be well-trained. If you're just an athlete, they literally see you in a different light. Like Americans, if someone finds out that you're a good athlete, one of their first thoughts is, ooh, can you coach me? In a lot of other countries like China, Russia, et cetera, if they find out you're a good athlete, they go, oh, that's really sweet. And if you're like, do you want me to coach you? They'd be like, are you a coach? And in America, it's like implied, right?
Right, right.
In Russia, it's by no means clear implied. You could just not be a coach. And you'll notice that the guys coaching in Russia, like Borisenko, he writes a lot of the top programs. He's like an old man. They'd be like, oh, yeah, what does Borisenko lift? Like, was he a good weightlifter? He was fine. Was he a good powerlifter? He was fine. Was he exceptional? No. But guys 50 times stronger than him put full trust in his programming efforts because that's what he does. Like, and they've recognized that. It's a little bit of a cultural shift that I think we have yet to go through in America to some extent.
So when I'm going shopping for a coach on, let's say,
the internet,
I look up hashtag FitFam, and I don't find the most jacked guy with the most abs, and I don't go hire him?
I mean, you probably should.
What about this?
He's going to magically be able to give you those abs.
That's what I assume.
Just from his body.
He has them. I want them.
Yeah, and it's
here's
one of
the money.
Right, and it's one of those things. Like, I think actually in bodybuilding, surprisingly, this isn't as bad. Like, contest prep coaches will look unremarkable. They're like old people. Like, Chad Nichols, as far as I'm concerned, is like an old man. And you'll get the best in the world working with him. Why? Because yeah. He produces results, right. Period. And nobody's like, how jacked is – like if someone in the high-level IFBB world was like, yeah, I was going to hire Chad Nichols, but then I looked him up and he wasn't jacked. Like you would get laughed at for saying that. To be like, he created Ronnie Coleman. Are you out of your mind?
Well, even last week you're in Europe with Brad Schoenfeld, hypertrophy god.
Yep.
Does not look as if he has won the hypertrophy himself.
No. Rad, so a combination of mostly just genetics, is very in super good shape, and he's a jacked guy. Is he the biggest guy on the planet? No. But a lot of people will say, oh, well, he's got nothing to teach me. Like, he's got everything to teach you, and yeah. If you just discard him, it's like looking at Borisenko's body composition and current lifts and be like, that's just some old man, bro. And then some guys who put deadlift at 800s, like, giving a seminar on it, and it's like, well, I reach down, I grab it, and then sometimes it goes up, and that's good. When it doesn't, I make some adjustments. Like, I just kind of psych up again and pull it, and you're like, wow, this is legendary. Tell us more of what you know. I think the combination is best, right? So
yeah.
Somebody who has been a competitor, maybe not an extremely good one, but has competed. Brad Schoenfeld's rich history of competition in bodybuilding. And someone who's competed a lot and has the formal qualifications and has coached a lot of people. That's another thing I think people miss out when they're shopping for coaches while we're on the subject, is you may actually have a person who's quite academically adept and is a good lifter themselves. They just haven't coached a lot of people. And that's a problem. I'm sure you guys could probably expound on how you get yourself into trouble like that with an inexperienced coach.
Yeah, and this is probably a topic for another episode. Max and I have touched on it in previous episodes about what is an expert, what constitutes an expert. And I really see that as a three-pronged thing of competitive success, coaching success, and education. Probably at least two out of the three need to be satisfied.
And one of them can't be terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and if you have someone with all three, then it's going to be great because you're going to have all the practical knowledge plus the deeper understanding of the principles and stuff.
Yep.
But going back to the question of, so if we establish that these youth coaches need to have high levels of understanding, if you're giving advice to incoming college freshmen about the best route for them to go to find this. And this could include specific schools, that have excellent programs or just their areas of focus. How would you help them design their best?
I think if you're an undergraduate and you're not completely sure what you want to do, do something in the biological sciences, get really good grades, and try to learn physiology really well. Everything in biology, even including psychology, can prepare you really well for doing biological systems, and a master's program can teach you the rest about how that applies to sport. But if you really know what you want to do, choose a kinesiology program that's emphasized a little bit. You're not going to see a lot of programs emphasized around sport, but you're going to want to choose the ones that are more sport-oriented versus ones that prepare you more for a clinical setting. Because there's a lot of programs in which even the undergraduate program is preparing you to be like an exercise physiologist at a hospital. Like that's their number one thing they prepare. Or pre-PT programs where you're going to be a physical therapist. You don't want that kind of stuff if you want to be a coach. There's no pre-coaching programs, but there's all around the country there are kind of scattered programs in kinesiology that have quite a bit of sport emphasis. And sometimes it's even in their titles. My biggest recommendation, look up the class progression. It's going to tell you what credits you need from what areas, and it's going to give you classes. If there's no class about training theory, weight training, nutrition, sport coaching at all in the entire handbook, that's not your school. Here's the thing. It may very well be a nice school, but nobody cares about that when you're a coach, and it doesn't really get you anywhere because you don't actually know anything. So, for example, if, as an undergraduate, just to go to a good undergrad, you may go to Harvard, Yale, whatever. You're going to learn a damn thing about how to train athletes at those places. It's just a name. Most of the best people in exercise science that I know went to undergrads in like really small liberal arts schools that just happen to have exercise science at a high level. And, you know, like, I don't even know where Brad Schoenfeld went to undergrad. Like, who gives a shit? You know, like, oh, he's from Harvard. Like, what did he learn at Harvard? Like, wow, like English literature of the 1400s. Like, that's nice. So it could prove that he was smart, right? So go to a program, try to get to a program that has those classes offered. Then the big decision comes of choosing a master's program geared towards sport performance and sport coaching, of which there are now quite a few, and you gotta search for them. You gotta find them. One way to find them is to look at who is the head research scientist at the labs. You basically find a bunch of the training articles on PubMed that you think are phenomenal, like research that you think is, oh my God, this research is incredible. Who's doing this research? Like comparing different styles of squatting and forces. Who published that article? Where are they? What school do they work for? Look up the school. Look up the master's program. Do they have one? Is it geared towards sport performance? If you check all those yes, is that professor taking master's students? And that's a simple phone call or email away to the administrators. They will say, yep, absolutely, and here's your application, and you apply. Apply to lots of schools because you might not get into one or two, and then choose your best. And then after that, you might do a PhD, but very likely you'll get involved in sport coaching at the program. And another thing, the best sport programs offer you an internship opportunity on site usually to do coaching. So when I got to Appalachian State, we worked in the lab and we had the option to work in the actual strength and conditioning room with football players, wrestlers, etc. A lot of schools just don't have that. At the University of Michigan, for example, the kinesiology department was literally across campus from where any of the athletes did anything. And there was no cross current at all. Like there's no graduate assistantships or anything like that. So make sure you pick a program that's going to get you involved in sport. PhDs are for people that are unbelievably curious about the deep mechanisms and the super elite performance of athletes. At a PhD program, you're going to have to take a couple of years away from coaching people at the highest level you can to continue your learning process. It's not for everyone. And I wouldn't really recommend it for people that just really want to be sport coaches and get, you know, people that really apply just want to get into the thick of things. If you want to develop new ideas, if you want to be a deep thinker about coaching to tell other coaches, help them with their jobs, a PhD program is for you. If you want to write books, articles, things like that. If you just want to get in the meat and potatoes, I would say a master's program is a really good place to stop your education.
Do you have any specific universities that you want to share as good recommendations that you hold in high esteem?
Unfortunately, not really, because if I said just a few names, I would be leaving so many out that I'm just not aware of. But I'll tell you what, I believe Lehman College in New York is where Brad Schoenfeld is a professor. So Lehman College, I believe that's where he's at, is where Brad Schoenfeld's a professor. And I don't know if there's a master's program there, but there's definitely an undergraduate program. If I was an undergrad and I was 17 years old and I was into lifting as much as I am now, and I knew who Brad Schoenfeld was, but that'd be the only application I'd fill out. You can go there and learn from him. I've literally been a guest speaker in his class because he has a class where half the class is individuals who are at a high level in coaching or authorities and textbook writers and things come and Skype with the class, and the students get to ask them questions on Skype of their choice. But that's at Michigan, oh my God, I didn't know who these people were. Yeah. There's no class like that. So find the researchers that do really good work, find where they work, and see if they're involved in their undergraduate curriculum. Another really quick tip, people may not always be involved with graduate students. So because a professor is somewhere doesn't mean he's involved with graduate students. For example, I've had a lot of people message me and say, I'm looking into the PhD program at Temple. I want to work with you. I have to tell them, I don't work with PhD students. It's not part of my salary. It's not part of my responsibilities. I don't have a mentorship there. I'm there to teach undergrads. And if you wanted to come to Temple and be an undergrad, yeah, you know, Dr. Hoffman and I will teach you all kinds of stuff. But if you want to go to the master's program, it's an entirely different curriculum altogether. So you got to find out, am I going to be learning the classes that I want? Am I going to be getting the practical experience that I want? And am I going to be studying under the very people that I go? If you can check all those off, get about 5 to 10 programs together, apply to them, it's all gravy after that. The huge disappointment is not doing that, showing up to a program in which you learn the same clinical basic exercise phys. Folks, master's programs are not free. They're the opposite of free. You will piss away $60,000 for 2 years of a master's program because you can't barely work. You got to take out loans for that. It's a lot of money. Just one really quick thing while I'm ranting. Education is a serious investment, but like all investments, there has to be a hypothesized return. There are no such thing as good things or bad things. There are effective and ineffective things. Some people will say, like, yeah, I'm going to go get my master's. And I'm like, what do you want to do with it? They're like, I'm not really sure. Like, oh my God. Did you buy an extra car that you don't even like just to have it around? Like, it's going to cost you money. What are you doing? Yeah. So really kind of figure out what you want. And the cool thing is, and I've done this between my master's and PhD, take some time off after your undergrad. Work, train people in personal training, in strength and conditioning. If you're of this mindset, you'll probably just get more and more pissed that the people around you are anti-scientific and you really love to go to a master's program and pay tons of money to learn science. But you could have a thing where you fit in really well and you have a great experience and then you don't have to go to a master's program.
Do you think a lack of continuity in some of these programs, like you were saying, you and James don't have involvement in the master's program, I'd imagine that it's not that's not the only example of universities around the
Absolutely.
Country. Absolutely. Do you think that the sport coaching education could be greatly improved through more continuity, for at least at a given university, between undergrad, master's?
Maybe. But the good workaround for that is, you know, James and I have a particular way of teaching and a particular way of doing things. We think we're mostly right, but we definitely get some stuff wrong, and our way of teaching may not resonate with everyone. And we don't have infinite insights to give. I mean, there's stuff we don't know. If you learn from us, and we've had a great graduating class this past year of individuals we wrote recommendations for, and they were accepted to other master's and PhD programs, and they went on to learn from someone else that was just as qualified, if not more, but just had a little bit of a different approach. And I think that diversity really allows you to experience a lot of different insights. It's like, instead of having coaches that you've just been creamed, you've just been sort of raised to be a weightlifting coach, maybe if the opportunity to coach powerlifters and swimmers too during some of that time, you really get a deep appreciation for what fatigue management really is. Because you're not going to – weightlifters, fatigue management is super important, but you never see someone that broken as after like low bar squatting for 8 weeks straight. You're like, wow, okay, your wrists are falling off, this and that. You mean – because – so if, to get that full perspective, I think it's actually a pretty good thing that you go from program to program to program. In an ideal world, yeah, there'd be super continuity. But I think you could do a pretty good job by making sure that when you finish your undergrad, ask your professors, hey, I have the following interests. Where should I go? And I've met with tons of students in my office for that. And I always tell them, Google the articles that you like the most and find out who publishes them. Find out where they are. Are their labs accepting master's students? You're good to go. Or what does their structure look like? Can you get in the weight room? Can you get work with football players? And
That one popped up to me as you were talking about University of Michigan and it being such a separation between the exercise science department and then the actual sport coaching. I think I said Vereshchansky earlier, and I meant to say Zatsarowski. The Zatsarowski.
Yeah, you butchered both of those names, so no worries.
Okay, whatever.
But they're not Americanese, are they?
How do you say it?
Zatsarowski, right?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
You were calling that butchered.
You said Zatsarowski.
Okay.
That's me calling you Wellesley.
You've probably done that before.
I probably have, for the purpose of trying to offend you.
So, Vladimir.
We were on a first-person basis.
Yeah. That's who the interview I was talking about was. And he was at Penn State, and there was clearly this big disconnect between the incredible amount of knowledge over here on campus, while meanwhile, Joe Pa and Sandusky are having everyone do HIIT training to play football.
Like, do you know who works at that lab down there? Like,
do you see that as you know, any practical ways that those two fields could be better merged or a bit more interaction?
A great question for Dr. Stone. If he were here, he'd have a huge rant on that. You know, ETSU is putting out PhD students that are getting into academia, and all of them are themselves athletes or were athletes and have a ton of coaching experience, and he wants them to get involved with teams, with coaches, to have an academic and athletic interaction. At East Tennessee State, we had one of the only programs in the country where the academics helped to coach. Incredibly rare.
When you went to ETSU, you were like the only person in your class, right, who hadn't been a college athlete, something like that?
Pretty much, yeah. Almost everyone was a college athlete, or at least, you know, lifting and had huge involvement in sport in some way or another. That was actually part of Dr. Stone's interview to people. A bunch of people said didn't get into the program because he's like, you know, you see, like, you know, you get someone's CV and you see they're academically qualified. He's like, you know, do you compete in sport? And one of the things he said is that you show up here, unless you're a competitive athlete in your own sport, you will compete for me in weightlifting. And a lot of people were like, no, I won't. And he's like, I won't see you here. Like, you're just expected to do that, unless you're like, you know, we had some endurance runners. I was a power lifter at the time. And that was like, unless you got your own thing going, you will compete in sport. Yeah. Because if you don't compete in sport, you have no idea what's going on. Nothing can replace the ecological first-person experience. So the other problem with that is that there's a bit of an anti-academic attitude in some sport coaching. On the athletic side, there's a good old boy club. And, well, this is how we did it. And championship rings don't lie. And there's that perspective where it's like a bit of an inferiority complex. Well, those brainy scientists have no idea what's going on. And up until recently, they were correct that brainy scientists would say really dumb stuff that doesn't apply to athletes because they were exercise physiologists.
Yeah.
Now they're sport physiologists mucking around, and they know their stuff. And I think they're going to be seeing more and more success. A lot of NBA teams, NFL teams are starting to hire sports scientists to help the coach out managing all sorts of things.
I think that would be great advice. You know, Dr. Stone's rule there, whether someone's in undergrad exercise science, in kinesiology, master's programs, whatever it is to be active in training. If your goal is to one day coach athletes, you have to understand that from a practical standpoint, I think, and whether that's seeking out a local weightlifting club, if it's not organized through the university, I think there's a lot of value in that.
I would take that even further. I would say if you want to become the most exceptional, even just theoretician or professor or coach, especially coach, it's not good enough to get the best results to simply be involved in sport. You're not a recreator, you're an athlete.
A sportsman,
that's right. So your number one mission should be for optimality. You should spend some time of your life, preferably as long as possible, engineering your own life to be as good as humanly possible at some sport. Only then will you get a true feel of the principles, a true feel of the limitations. You may program all kinds of ridiculous stuff that doesn't work in real life unless you've pushed it yourself. I had a student write a program for football players, offensive linemen once, which was 5x12 pull-ups. I don't know a single offensive lineman in the United States that can do 5 pull-ups. 12 is one hell of an accomplishment. 5x12 is an impossibility. So I just want to be like
very optimistic about that line.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. It's like, if I get through it, you know. So it's one of those situations where, you know, haven't you done pull-ups? And like, yeah, a couple here and there. Recreationally, if you do pull-ups, fine. But if you try your damnedest to get as strong of a back as possible, you will quickly run up to the idea that at 170 pounds, you can only do 20 good pull-ups. And that all of your friends that train with you that are 240, 250, 260 could barely do 5 or 6 or 7. You would just never do it.
Yeah.
So I think in addition to that, you know, something like fatigue management. How do your volleyball players feel after a really hard game? Should you give them the day off the next day? Should it be light practice? Should it be hard practice? Should we gut it through? You can come up with all sorts of interesting ideas, but unless you've lived the life of pushing your body to its limits, you can't see some of the exotic stuff that happens because it's one of those things that's like particle physics almost. You speed up particles enough and give them high enough energies. Super fucking weird shit happens. Unless you've been around that stuff, you're like, oh, yeah, I'll just smash into each other and be fine. Like, no, that's a fucking nuclear reaction. When you are performing at a high level in sport, sorry, not performing, trying your very hardest to live your life exactly, to do the best that you can, you find out that there's all sorts of constraints and all sorts of strategies that work and a bunch of shit that just fucking doesn't. And I don't think, like Jared, one of the things when he was my student, one of the things that stood out to me was we had a very short conversations. It was one of those like say no more fam conversations where I was like, how good do you want to be in bodybuilding? And Jared basically was like, I'm going to die for the sport. And I'm like, say no more. Like, you would live your entire life to be as good as you possibly can. You don't have to do that forever. When you're in your 40s and got kids and stuff, you're like, sorry, I got to go work out and get my nutrients right after a baby's crying and shit like that. But if you have lived the life, if you've suffered, if you've engineered your existence to be the best, you almost certainly won't get to be the best. But when someone who wants to be the best looks to you and goes for advice, you can say, I've walked that path before. I can take you really far because I've seen really nasty things. I've seen really great things. I've seen that path. Like, if you were coaching a guy who's trying to squat close to a grand, squatting close to a grand is all sort of considerations. Squatting 500 just doesn't. And more particularly, squatting super heavy and trying your best has all sorts of considerations that just squatting for fun does not.
Yeah, like, and that it's very hard to capture a lot of these ideas in the way that, you know, experiments and studies are
too many. You have to do too many studies, absolutely, and there's not enough population. I remember one particularly good example that immediately struck me as completely insane was there were some individuals that were saying, well, you know, the abdominals are not involved in the squat, and they have nothing to do with squatting. It's your spinal erectors. And I knew where they were coming from because I knew the biomechanics. Yes, the spinal erectors actually lift the weight for you and make sure your back doesn't round, but they didn't give enough credence to intra-abdominal pressure. Why? Because they were squatting 220 pounds, 230 pounds. Right, right. I knew who they were. You don't need intra-abdominal pressure to squat that. But I myself, you know, as soon as I got, you know, and I don't have amazing genetics or anything, but for me, anything over 400 pounds in the squat when I started squatting those weights, it wasn't – it's not a squat. You get underweight that just – you guys know that feel of fat and okay, so you figure out really within day one that I'm gonna have to pump this up. I'm gonna have to use my abs because otherwise everything collapses. Just from looking at a free body diagram, you may not infer that. And if you've tried your very hardest, maybe I've never. If I was programming for you, Chad, maybe I've never squatted 900 pounds for sure. But when you say, look, that squat beat my ass, I know what the ass beat feels like. If I don't, I'll be like, oh, I'll just give you a day off and you'll come back and hit it. It's like that doesn't carry over like that. Yeah. So.
That's interesting because I think that goes a lot too to like when you talk about coaching other sports, you know, weightlifting and powerlifting or swimming. But like if you have an understanding of – if you have experience in a lot of different realms like that, it broadens your understanding of how those different principles work. Oh my God, and that's, it's such a huge it's such a big component of being a good coach is that you have – not just like this really specific knowledge of like, oh, I was a weightlifter for 5 years. I know how it feels and kind of do this. But you have a really broad understanding of like, you know, things like fatigue management and specificity and stuff. And you can look at the entire spectrum of it and how it works as its own kind of machine, not just, hey, here's a recipe for this particular sport. It kind of works for this guy.
Right? So many people that come from one sport only. Just no recipes. They're like, oh, well, we'll run this progression. Yeah. And you're like, why that progression? They can't explain it. Like, we'll do fives. Why fives? One question you ask to a kind of undergrad exercise physiology student to mess with them, and it doesn't work with most master students because they understand the principles. Why don't we do fours? And usually, like, an undergrad would be like, oh, well, because why would you do that? And be like, what's the trade-offs there? What about sixes, you know? But if you have a variety of sport experience and you know all the principles kind of from a foundational level, your ability to be creative and programming is, like, monumentally higher. Like, some of the – it's funny, like – recently, Jared and I were talking about your kind of newer thing that you're doing is you're having really hard deadlift weeks for your athletes, really hard squat weeks and really hard bench weeks, and some of those are mixed together. Mm-hmm. But there's this second-level pulsatility to your programs. There's never a feature of my programming, and I was like, damn, dude, that is – I was like – I remember you explained that the first time I ever heard you talking about it. I was like, that is next-level shit. That is awesome. But you can't tell that that's a good idea unless you've deadlifted on Monday and you got heavy squats on Wednesday and you're like, the fuck was I thinking programming this? My back doesn't work. Like, maybe if I spread it out a little bit more, shit could happen. So it's one of those things like, physiology knowledge, critical. And then on top of that, deep knowledge, both from study and from experience. There's some shit people recommend because they don't experience it. I have no idea. Well, I have an idea as to how they come to ridiculous conclusions. They haven't experienced it. Now, a lot of us comes up with fatigue management. People say, like, fatigue management's really not, like, a big issue. I mean, like, if you just train, you'll get gains. You don't have to deload all the time. Like, the anti-deload argument is just insane. If you've pushed it, you know exactly your body will fucking break or you will deload. Like, you're, what is it? Like, you know, you're, how long did you do, like, squatting and snatching and stuff every day?
Maybe 15, 13 years.
Something so, like, when people tell you, like, oh, specificity is, like, the only thing that matters in overload, you're probably like, is that right?
Yeah, this is not.
You may have that idea, but I've walked that path, and it's monumentally stupid. Like,
Yeah, for sure.
I really enjoy when people try and chime in on squatting every day, like, on one of Max's videos, and I'm sure that, you know, they read an article about it, and maybe they did it for a month or 3 months or maybe even a year.
I've rode that horse as far as it rode.
The horse was dead. The horse was dead for a very long time.
You continued to ride it while it was dead.
Just drug it behind me.
It's got like a smelly skeleton of a horse.
Yeah, I think that the idea of being able to coach multiple sports goes so far to the idea of what we try and do with a lot of this stuff is understand the principle. And if you understand the principles that make good training and can frame it for swimming, for basketball, for football, you know, you don't have to have played it. It would be a nice bonus, but, like, I've coached, obviously, all strength sports, but in particularly the first 3 years of Juggernaut, the main sports that we coached were swimming, water polo, jiu-jitsu, and football. You know, I was a pretty good Irvine Nova swimmer under age 12.
That's a funny idea for me, your current body size.
Well, Marissa called me Wesley the Great White when she saw the swimming skills on display in Australia.
Oh, well.
Wow.
On land, Wesley the Koala, by sea, the Great White.
I'd only played two of those sports ever, but was able to be successful in coaching them because you understand, you know, one, you watch the sport. Right. You see what happens. You understand what the important, you know, takeaways are from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Mankini, as you look back on your last, what, 6 years of college and master's programs, what do you wish that a young, you know, probably better haircutted Jared
Roto
Feather
Mankini
would have known entering college?
Like Mike said, because he had discussions with others as well. Probably myself was one of these discussions, how I didn't really branch out, look up who was who in the industry or anything. It was the thing that it was local, it was cheap, it was that's what I was going to do. You know, you go to a university, you get a degree, that's the expected route. Yeah, it's the expected route. So I was just like, all right, cool, I'll apply to this university. It's cheap. It's the cheapest one in Missouri. I don't have to pay out of state, and that's what I did. And looking back, I mean, yeah, I lucked out with a lot of things, like Mike showing up and, you know, getting in touch with RP, all the professors there. But that also could have never happened, too. I could have went and studied on a Schoenfeld, like you said. So if I really enjoyed training and diet as much as I thought I did at the time, maybe I should have looked into some of those people who were actually experts in training and dieting. I didn't do that. Looking back, it probably would have been a smarter move to definitely make some of those decisions right at the forefront and maybe go somewhere and learn from some real experts, not just some, you know, lower level university that wants you to, like he said, it pushes you to be like a clinical setting person. I don't know precisely. I think it's a pre-PT program is what exercise science is at UCM. Pre-PT and
a huge PT
clinical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's where I went, and I had no idea that's what that was until like my second year in the program. They're like, oh no, this is preparing you for this. So I'm like, I don't know. Do that. And then Mike showed up and it kind of, my direction changed.
Yeah, and it was 2 years ago now, I guess, that Mike connected us and you came out for that internship. You know, how do you think internships for yourself, for other students, really fit into the education process?
It's one thing that hopefully all exercise science, all kinesiology programs, hopefully they recommend that you get an internship, because this was definitely a big changing point in my knowledge over like weightlifting and powerlifting, periodization and programming. I'd never done anything like that. Like I said, with the courses, my biggest thing was first, before I ever even did coaching or anything, I helped family members and friends. Then I moved on to people at the university setting that would reach out to me for help. Then I moved on to maybe I could make this kind of a coaching thing once I was under Mike for a little while, and he kind of, you know, passed that idea along to me as well. And even then it was like, I need more. I need, you know, those internship opportunities, like the one here especially, when I heard about this and Mike kind of, you know, passed it along, I was like, I have to go do that. That is what I want to do with my life. I want to, you know, coach athletes. I want to coach high-level powerlifters, high-level bodybuilders, and just learning how to periodize in any form, like whether that was – if I came here and you were like a you know, a football coach, learning how to periodize for athletes in general carries over to so much more, to periodize for bodybuilding, for hypertrophy in general, strength in general. And I think not taking the internship lightly, because what I see a lot of my friends do is they – you know, they go to the head professor of the department and they're like, so what personal training studios are hiring in the local town next to us? Can you like recommend me? And it's like, don't.
It's like an inconvenience to them.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, yeah. I just want to get
they're selling yourself short, just like they're just selling yourself short just by getting the degree and not actually trying to like conceptualize information that they're learning.
Well, and that's the thing that, you know, academia, whatever, that people have to understand. If they want to be great coaches, they want to be great, you know, athletes, making the sacrifice of figuring out a way to get yourself from Missouri to California when you're, you know, 20 or 21 years old then, so you can sleep on couches for 3 months and learn. Whether it's, you know,
yeah,
driving 2 hours so you get to train in a negative 40 degree garage. You know, I remember paying for myself to fly to New York before my senior year of college. And then, you know, renting a car to drive out and to talk to Joe DeFranco for the day, and, you know, going to these track meets for hours and hours, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours, and just waiting for like the coach to walk over the shop foot so I could pepper him with questions until he shooed me away.
Yeah.
But being willing to make those kind of sacrifices, and it's so apparent. You know, the this year we didn't do that intern applications, but the previous 2 years is doing these applications, and we got, you know, maybe 80 the first year, 120, 130 the next year. And some of them were from people who live 10 minutes away, and some of them were for people who live 10,000 miles. I mean, people who are from Australia who wanted to fly to California, looking Jackson back here again today.
He's here training.
Yeah, people who are willing to travel the world to sacrifice comfort, you know, to sacrifice short-term monetary stability probably to really chase their passion and to further their knowledge and further their everything about their about what they're passionate about.
Yeah.
One thing that has always baffled me is people have kind of recently been getting this question a little more, and it came up at the hypertrophy seminar I did with Steve Hall. And someone asked, like, you know, we were up at the front asking questions, and someone's like, how do I get to where you are? And, like, I, you know, I was asking basically, like, how do you get to be, like, oh, Dick Swing and Dr. Mike Hizertal from Facebook, like, super expert, whatever. And the answer is, I never planned to be Dr. Mike Hizertal from Facebook. I didn't have, like, a world domination plan. People still ask me questions like, oh, you know, like, you could be super, like, you can speak really well, you're sort of not entirely unfunny, and, man, you, like, got so much potential. I don't give a fuck about potential, but it's never come up. I have no fucking clue if I'm going to break my leg tomorrow or split my head open and out goes the Jew brain and no more good ideas. All I ever wanted was to be involved in sport. I coached people before. Honestly, this is a fucked up admission. I coached people before I really knew what I was doing just because I wanted the fucking experience. Mm-hmm. I need educated guesses that were not very educated because I so desperately wanted to see how things worked. I didn't train myself to become Dr. Mike Hizertal and to have a resume of, oh, he's also jacked and a professor. I train because it's in my fucking soul, because I want to be as good as I can be at all times to grow. And so you want to get up to a high level, want to put in the work to be better and better and better and love the work. If you can do that, it doesn't fucking matter if you have a plan or not. You just get good and people come to you and ask you questions and shit, you know, like, if you have a plan, like, ooh, I'm going to do this and that, and then I'll be jacked enough to be an authority figure, this and that, like, nah. You want to be jacked, it's got to be jacked. You want to be strong, it's got to be strong. How strong? Strong as you can be. You exhaust all those possibilities. One thing I have, like a pet peeve, how much do I want to know about sports science?
everything, every fucking thing. I want to be a fucking expert. I don't. My goal is not to be an expert. My goal is to know more. It pisses me off that I know I don't know enough, and I never know enough. I just want to learn all the fucking time. So, quote unquote, easy path to success. Make yourself uncomfortable and go get better at everything you want to be good at. And that doesn't end when you get good enough and now you're like living a high life or whatever. Always continue to get better. The results aren't, oh, now you're this like Instagram or Facebook celebrity or whatever, and oh, people think you're cool. The result is you like the life that you've built for yourself because it involved doing cool shit like learning more and being stronger and being bigger and coaching awesome athletes. Like, that's the point, is just continue to do that. So if you have this big grandiose goal, but you hate everything it takes to get there, just get the fuck out of the way. Go do something else. If you want to be super passionate and you don't give a shit if coaching brings you nothing at all, you just want to coach people because you love coaching. You want to get stronger. You want to get stronger because it burns every day inside of you like an undiagnosed, you know, STD or something like that, which I know nothing about from personal experience. If you want it, Jared's awful weird about this. Jared, it's strange that you seem to not say anything about this particular thing. So if you want that lifestyle, like, I don't, like, for you, Max, like, you always struck me as a guy who's like, you know, like Max is so brilliant and knows so much sport theory. Sometimes I ask myself, like, dead serious. I'm like, why isn't he like more on social media and answering questions and all this bullshit? And then I figured out, you want to coach and you like coaching, and that's what you're doing. That's it. Just do that, and then all the other shit comes along with it. There's no goal. There's just do what you do and get better at it. That's it.
I think like a lot of the people that are really successful at this stuff, and probably everybody at this table, is probably in the same place where there's some other real reason behind it. It's like, you know, not that like, you know, your uncle molested you when you were like 12.
Also Jared. True.
And like, you're like, you know, I got to get back at him. But it's like, there's definitely like, there's an underlying like chip, I don't know, a chip on the shoulder, obsession with something that like, you get into it at least because of that. Because you're starting to like, I just got to get strong. I got to learn this and that. And so just that thirst for it just grows and grows until you eventually get into, you know, more advanced places where you start to realize you have to learn other things or become better at certain parts of the job, whatever it is. But it always seems to come about, like, the best coaches and people I've known, the, like someone like Dr. Stone, never met him, but I believe his personality probably lends itself to that, you know, being sort of right about something or having this kind of obsessive
not knowing.
You know what I mean? Like,
and he's working all the time to know shit.
And it's like, that's the thing that's driving you to do it. Whereas like someone's looking at like Dr. Mike, how do I be you? How do I become that? They're just looking at what they see as this kind of, that looks like a fun lifestyle, you know?
But I guess. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's really like the thing that you are. That's just like the thing that you become because of what you're chasing.
Yeah. And to be honest, like the whole Dr. Mike thing, I like very rarely reflect on it, but when I do, I'm like, oh, I guess that's cool. All right, what am I writing next?
Yeah.
You know, like, who am I coaching next? What kind of theories am I developing? What about my own training? Like, it's super fucked up. Like, I go to conferences now and talk a lot and like do all these seminars and stuff. My number one priority when I travel anywhere is, can I get my meals in and can I get training in? I will straight up be like, they're like, oh, we're gonna hang out and hobnob with people. I'm like, cool. I'm gonna go train. And it's awesome because I was just at the sport conference in Netherlands. Pretty much everyone there was the same way. So we watched each other's lectures, but at least one person at a time would be gone because they were training.
Nice.
Like, we all train. Like, this is, I'm not going to sit 8 hours, watch lectures. I got to go train. I'll come back and all that stuff. But it was one of these things like, you know, what is Brad Schoenfeld? Brad Schoenfeld left and went to go train. And you could ask, like, what is he training for? He's like 40-something-year-old man. Like, he's not an athlete anymore. Like, why is he training? Because it's who he is. Why do you think he likes researching this stuff? Because he trains, like, period. So if you're one of these guys, like, can I use training to become famous? Good luck. It's going to suck. It's going to be a shitty life. You're going to find yourself, even if you do get a lot of success, you're going to find that you hate what you do. And if you want to hate what you do and be successful, just go be a lawyer or a financial analyst or some shit. I don't know. Unless you really like that stuff. Jared, you probably get off on that kind of
definitely.
Shit.
Yeah, definitely. I think you touched on it, and like with people asking.
I didn't touch on it.
He touched on a lot of things. you know, how do you be Dr. Mike and all that stuff. I imagine like all of us, when we are presented opportunities to do something that, you know, we have that chip on our shoulder and we needed a better understanding of physiology or a better understanding of sports science. So when Mike showed up, there was an opportunity. And the first day that I saw him in the gym, I walked up to him. I just started an organization on my campus. I said, hey, Mike, I want you to be our advisor. Like, I took advantage of the opportunities that were in front of me, even if they weren't presented. You have to go. You have to search for those opportunities. You have to seize every opportunity you can, because if you don't and you're letting these opportunities pass you, then maybe you're not as passionate about it as you think. You have to just take a hold of it and go do them.
You're just showing up is a good start.
Yeah, for sure. Show up. Because then they just come. You know, they might take longer for opportunities to show up, but once they do, you don't let it pass.
And you guys probably have more insight on this, but like, if you just simply come to like Juggernaut or like a sport coaching organization, like some kind of team, and you say, hey, listen, I don't want any formal title, I want anything. How can I help you guys? I just want to help. Most coaches are going to be like, sweet. Stack those boxes and come in tomorrow.
Yeah.
Clean the weights. And after a while, they get to know you. They know you're a thinker. You ask questions every now and again when you've earned the right to do so. And they're like, are you going to apply to the master's program here? Because you're pretty good, man. You can come in and have a formal job. And when they see that you're on the resume and they're choosing interns, they're like, oh, everyone's irrelevant. We already know this person. So people think like, oh, I need like a formal title and a formal internship. Just go and try to learn and try to help. Try to help people that you know need help, and it'll get you exposed to a lot of stuff.
So I think if we're to kind of sum up the real big points here, if you're 18 years old, you listen to this, you're getting ready, or you're whatever age, and you're getting ready to venture, you know, begin your venture into being a coach, learning as much as you can about this, you know, research, read what the classes that you're going to take really are. Don't be satisfied to just go down, you know, down the street to the closest school because it's convenient to you, but make the sacrifices, you know, that you need to go to the best place that you can find. And you're going to probably find that by reading these research and seeing who is writing it. Yeah. Then from there, you know, you have to take every advantage of internships. Again, if those are going to probably require sacrifices as well, but you're 19, 20 years old, and who gives a shit if you sleep on a couch, for the summer, or you sleep on the floor for the summer. Go and attack that opportunity. When you are presented with someone like in the great chance that you guys had to work together, you know, never be afraid to go and ask the person questions. What, you know, the worst they're going to say is no. Submerge yourself in what you want to do. So if there's no training component to the program you're in, find the best place you can to train alongside of it. You know, live the life of the people who you hope to one day coach and help in their sport. And then as you get into the more advanced education, the master's, PhD levels, I mean, one certainly decide if it's for you, if that investment is necessary, if it's going to have the return you want. Look again further into the program that you're going to. Don't just select it because of a prestigious school name or proximity or whatever it is, but make sure it's going to teach you what you want to learn, because you're the one who's there paying for it. And then never be satisfied in what you have. Never be satisfied in that you know enough, because none of us know it all, right? And we're never going to. So if you're someone who's continually chasing to not, you know, not trying to chase the end goal, but chase the process, to pursue the process of more knowledge, of more strength, of more effective coaching, then I think we gave a pretty good blueprint to become Dr. Mike. So you rub Rogaine all over your body, except not on your head.
You got to get friends to do like the back and stuff, because it's tough.
Me specifically.
Mankini.
How do you become Mankini? That's another good question.
Put one on.
Haircut, just randomly select.
Fill a tub with hair removal cream.
Pour it on most of your head. Okay, so really quick, I think this is something we didn't really touch on. It's really important. My Sprite Zero bottle has little convexities everywhere. Does that mean that if I rub them onto my thighs, it'll make me more scar tissued and more fatigued?
Yeah, it puts them back in. It's a reverse foam roller.
I can't believe I've had this in my hands. Like, my hands, my jiu-jitsu fingers are probably even more fucked. It's like, now. This is like a Sue Sprite.
Matter and antimatter.
So what's coming up next for you guys? Mankini? When's your Mankini show?
I'm prepping for my first professional bodybuilding show.
It's a big show, too, huh?
Yeah, it's the biggest natural bodybuilding show, I think, in IPE. They merged all the natural organizations now, so that way anyone in any natural organization who's pro can compete.
For would it be called the Supernatural Show then?
Well, I'm doing the World Championships after my first show, but I'm doing the first show. It's called the Minnesota Mayhem. Uh-huh. As you guys would say, it's the what team? The hockey team that plays?
A rival of the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah, the rival of the Mighty Ducks, Minnesota Mayhem.
So do you get, do you think, District bonus five. Points for the ICP face paint?
Do you the put the paint? Is it everyone's painted? Face yeah. painted or just not the, tan?
So, well, technically, yeah, we're all painted.
Right. Just the face or everything?
Everything.
Okay.
yeah.
And
yeah, so that's in October.
You're chronicling your preparation for that on YouTube?
Yeah, yeah. I just started that vlog that I'm doing for RP, kind of a side project. It's a little thing that I'm while I'm out here, and I'm basically filming some sets and talking over it and trying to give people more of an insight as to how to actually periodize for a bodybuilding show or preparatory for a bodybuilding
people
show.
People love that stuff, man, because that's yeah. where I leave it off. I just talk about principles.
Yeah, he talks about principles, and I'm showing how to kind of conceptualize it, apply it, and actually practically, you know, go in and periodize for yourself.
And where can they watch that?
It's just my name on YouTube, Jared Feather. I imagine we'll upload it to the Renaissance Periodization YouTube channel as well, so that way it's also
and good. When are you going to finally take my advice and embrace Mankini. The Mankini brand?
Let me just, I'll just go change my handle on Instagram right now for you.
Good. And what is your current Instagram?
Jared underscore Feather.
Just and tell him the new one.
Changing to at MANKINI 69.
That part was never.
Mike, what do you got next?
I'm done. I'm retiring.
Seminars and whatnot.
So I just got back from a combination of going to a seminar in London and the Amsterdam, and then I spent one day, half a day in Philly, and then I spent half a day in California, and then I'm off to go 2 weeks with Dr. Melissa Davis and Dr. James Hoffman to do RP Whirlwind Australia Tour. So to say that I have no fucking idea what time it is an understatement. I have no idea what's going on.
This episode is being filmed at 3:30 a.m. right now.
I would feel quite more normal if it was.
Probably about 72 hours from Amsterdam to Australia, with a little bit of America in between.
Yeah.
That's a terrible travel schedule.
It's rough, yeah. You already critiqued it on technical grounds. Wesley's a world traveler. He's Magellan-like, told me what I was doing wrong.
So you went the wrong direction.
So in any case, in retrospect, I probably should have just, but that's a lot of packing. But anyway, so I'm going to Australia. Aussie folks, see you there. And then after that, I'm, thank God, settling in and producing a ton of awesome content. We've got some super secret awesome plans at RP to make your guys' lives harder and more painful. We stopped trying to make them easier and more effective. Mm-hmm. We figured we'd go the other way. So I'm going to be working a lot, producing all kinds of great content and doing all kinds of podcasts and stuff. Steve Hall and I have a busy schedule of doing his podcast to continue to answer questions. And thank God I get to just live in my own home and eat and train. And I'm going to be doing another mass phase to go up to about 245 pounds. And then I start dieting for possibly a show in December, but we'll see how the diet goes. Always experimenting and tweaking stuff. And so I can continue to be a less than, incrementally less mediocre bodybuilder.
Yeah. What's the actual terminology that was used?
You got jokes?
I don't remember what it was. I guess it was mediocre.
Spit it out.
Where can they follow you? Where can they find you?
Mike Isratel on Facebook. It's a public account. You can come follow me and troll me. At RP Dr. Mike for mostly pictures of food, myself half naked, and strange combinations of the two. To you folks, not strange at all.
RPDR Mike.
Yep, RPDR M-I-K-E. And then at RP Strength on Instagram for some incredibly good-looking people with transformations all up and down. Awesome pictures of food and super cool motivational quotes. And that's where we're at. RenaissancePeridization.com.
You guys are pretty big on the memes.
We're big on the memes. People love the memes. They really do. Memetically inclined people. And I'll see you on the internet.
Montana.
You can find me on Instagram, max_ada. You can email me maxjtsstrength.com or on Facebook if you have questions about coaching or the online programs through Juggernaut.
Seminar.
I've got a seminar up in North Carolina, July 8th, and then after that we'll be at the Pan Ams.
They contact you for the seminar? Or
yeah, you can just shoot an email to Max JTS Strength for the seminar info.
What's your Max's Gym Instagram? What's the handle for that?
Max's Gym. Wow. Yeah, there's there a gym up in Oakland. I have a gym
in Oakland. Crazy. Yeah, I follow that.
Go to max'sgym.net.
Is that a good idea?
Just try it.
Okay. You'll like it.
Don't do it
close to it's really up your alley.
Don't do it close to a school or something like that. I gotcha.
All right. I'm Chad Wesley Smith at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your news feed all day. Just announced a seminar in Mike's Hood, 2-day event in Philadelphia, September 16th and 17th at Warhorse Barbell. Marissa and I will be out there on the 16th. I'll just be talking at you, lecturing about powerlifting program design, talking about the principles of it, and then the practical side of how I actually create programs and the different considerations I make there, with the next day Marissa and I doing the hands-on practical coaching of the squat bench deadlift technique. Other seminars that'll get announced pretty soon: Minneapolis, as well as Dublin, that's in Ireland, and Manchester,
not England. Dublin, Ohio.
No. I get no love in Ohio. Yeah, we all know about that. Ohio's most wanted. And if you haven't checked out juggernautcoaching.com for our weightlifting, powerlifting, and super total coaching, and make sure you subscribe to the YouTube, the best fitness content there is, the PBS of fitness YouTubes.
Well, that's hoity-toity.
Thanks for watching, and if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes. It'll help us get up those lists so more people find us and they can learn great info like today. Thank you, gentlemen.
Our pleasure.